From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Terry Gross. The new film Together is a coming-of-age story about a Chinese boy who plays violin. The boy and his father travel to Beijing, but the competitive world of classical music proves daunting. On today's Fresh Air, we meet Together's director, writer, and producer, Chen Kaige. His work includes the Oscar-nominated film Farewell, My Concubine. Also, we pay tribute to Bob Hope. Today is his 100th birthday. And linguist Jeff Nunberg explores the idea that some cultures lack certain descriptive words. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. A three-hour meeting between Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas and Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon has ended. NPR's Peter Kenyon says Sharon's office has released some details about the meeting.
The Israeli Foreign Ministry said Mr. Sharon demanded decisive action from Abbas against terrorists, including seizing weapons and arresting those who carry out attacks. The Prime Minister's office added that Mr. Sharon may now order a withdrawal of Israeli forces from some Palestinian city centers. This follows news that Mr. Abbas is confident about getting a ceasefire with the Hamas faction. There's at least one report that Islamic Jihad is also considering a ceasefire. On the other hand, different news from the Al-Aqsa Brigade, which has been linked to the Fatah movement. It says it's not considering a ceasefire, either inside Israel or in the Palestinian territories.
NPR's Peter Kenyon in Jerusalem. Today's meeting is seen as a prelude to separate meetings scheduled for next Wednesday between both leaders and President Bush. British Prime Minister Tony Blair visited southern Iraq today, becoming the first Western leader to visit that country since the U.S.-led war. Blair told British troops that the nation was united in support for them, despite divisions over the war.
I know there are a lot of disagreements in the country about the wisdom of my decision to order the action, but I can assure you of one thing. There's absolutely no dispute in Britain at all about your professionalism and your courage and your dedication.
Blair's visit came amid new controversy in Britain over whether Blair's government deceived Parliament and the public about intelligence that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. A federal judge has refused to block the expulsion of a Chicago-area high school senior who took part in a hazing incident. Glenbrook North High School expelled 31 students after the episode in early May. Jay Field reports from Chicago Public Radio.
The hazing was captured on video. On the tape, played over and over on TV, a group of senior girls hit and smear a crowd of junior girls with mud, garbage, paint, and feces. Last week, Glenbrook North High School expelled 18-year-old senior Liat Gendelman and 30 other students. An attorney for Gendelman had asked federal judge Charles Kokoris to issue a restraining order blocking the expulsions. Gendelman's lawyer claimed the hazing tape might actually show her client comforting her fellow students instead of harassing them. But the judge turned down the request, indicating the tape could hurt Gendelman's case. The expelled students can get their diplomas if they fulfill counseling and community service requirements. For NPR News, I'm Jay Field in Chicago.
Stock prices came to a mixed close today on Wall Street. The Dow Industrials lost 81 points, about 1%, to close at 8,711 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq gained 12 points. It closed at 1574. This is NPR News. India has tested a surface-to-air missile as part of a weapons development program the country says it needs to strengthen its defenses in Asia. The test comes as India and Pakistan are taking steps to improve relations. Veer Singh reports from New Delhi.
The medium-range missile has been successfully tested at a remote range in eastern India over the Bay of Bengal. India has already conducted several tests of the weapon named Akash, which can travel up to 16 miles and can carry a payload of more than 100 pounds. India has test-fired other longer-range missiles which can hit targets deep inside Pakistan and China. However, New Delhi says its missile tests are not directed at any one country, but instead aim to increase India's security. The tests come as India and Pakistan have restored diplomatic ties and are planning to reopen some transport links after a gap of almost a year and a half. For NPR News, I'm Veer Singh in New Delhi.
U.S. military commanders in Iraq say more U.S. troops may be sent into combat operations after a series of attacks and accidents left six American soldiers dead since Sunday. The latest American killed was a soldier who was hit when his convoy was fired upon by a rocket-propelled grenade. Lieutenant General David McKiernan says the attacks have been carried out by loyalists of Saddam Hussein's defunct Ba'ath Party. He said he may deploy more troops in the town of Fallujah near Baghdad, where U.S. troops have clashed several times with gunmen. McKiernan also says the Army's 3rd Infantry Division will remain in Iraq for now. The division had been expected to return home next month. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Saab. Welcome to the State of Independence, where all cars are turbocharged. Information and dealer locator at saabusa.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. Chen Kaiga is best known for his films Farewell, My Concubine and Temptress Moon, both epic stories of loss and betrayal. These are themes Kaiga understands well. As a teenager during the Cultural Revolution, he was forced to denounce his own father, also a well-known filmmaker. In his new film, Together, Kaiga takes a true story involving a father and his musically gifted son and weaves a coming-of-age tale infused with more light and optimism than his earlier work. The cast includes many non-actors. Kaiga himself has a role in the film. The central conflict involves a choice the child has to make between two violin teachers. Terry asked Kaiga to describe them.
The first one is the one that sort of, culturally, I mean, he got lost. And he's the one sort of way behind the time, you know. And he doesn't know how to handle his own life, but he's the one believe in music. He's the one believe that those kids should play the instrument with their hearts.
And he's kind of broke. He's not really interested in money. he's pretty bohemian and disheveled in a pretty bohemian kind of way.
Yes, but I'm familiar with this kind of intellectual, mm-hmm. you know. And I think he may represent so-called old culture, an old value, and represents something that we used to believe a lot, you know. And, my father, not necessarily just like him, but, you know, I mean, many, many people in my father's generation are just like that. And the second one, you know, the one played by myself, is the one that I consider as a star maker. You know, he can guarantee the success for his students. And he represents, you know, I mean, the current value of Chinese society today.
Why did you cast yourself as the star-making teacher as opposed to the intellectual teacher who reminded you of your father?
Well, the thing is that, you know, I mean, I had a problem to cast, you know, this guy because, you know, those professors either were too busy or not experienced to work in front of camera. That's the problem. So one day that a friend of mine who's also a director came to me and just say, you know, I know you really worry about that, but why don't you just cast yourself? I said, so why you say this? And he said that I saw you work, you know, on set with your actor, you know, you're pretty much like this guy. And I think no one can really understand do better than you are. You do. And I said, okay, I try. I think the reason I want to decide to do that is that I'm almost in the same situation with this professor. You know, I'm considered by many Chinese people that I'm a star maker. You know, I can, for example, this young boy, the young violinist, after he did my movie and he became sort of celebrity in China and he received a lot of interviews and he became somebody. You know, in the school compound, And his life's been dramatically changed. And he used to study in Shanghai. Now he moved from Shanghai to Beijing, becomes a student of number one professor in China. So I want to ask my question by doing this part. Am I doing the same thing like what he does in this movie or not? Whether there's a difference between this guy and me, you know, what I really believe, what I really want, you know. I think I got answer after did this part.
What was the answer?
The answer is that there's a huge difference, you know, between this guy and me. You know, I don't have that kind of, you know, I mean, moral problem, I guess, that, you know, I will never really push so hard to let my actor do things they don't want to do. You know, that's not me. And I sort of denounce that kind of, you know, totally reject that kind of value. I don't believe that.
What kinds of things would the teacher push his students to do that they wouldn't want to do?
The thing is that, you know, they always say you need more time. They all believe, you know, I mean, to be a musician is a technical thing. You know, if you are more patient, if you practice, you know, spend more time to practice, you can guarantee yourself, like, you know, you can be a very good musician. It's completely wrong. I mean, if you don't play with your heart, you will never, ever be a good musician, you know. But they never taught their students like that.
When you were making Together, did you have to submit the film to Chinese censors, or did you even have to submit the script before you made the film to Chinese censors to make sure that it was acceptable to them?
Yes, I did. You know, this is the process that I need to submit the screenplay to the National Film Bureau first. Let them to prove it. I think they have a committee, and the member of the committee are not necessarily only the government officials, but including some old filmmakers. And they just look at the script. But this time I was okay with the script. They just say, go ahead and shoot it. But afterwards, that I thought that I was pretty safe, but someone, you know, talked to me nicely, and they just say, look, we're not really in favor of the character you played. So is there any way to do a slight change or something? I said in a very nice way as well. I said, unfortunately, that this movie is officially finished because, you know, the post-production is finished. There's no way to add anything in or change, you know, even slightly. So then they say, okay, so that's it.
Farewell, My Concubine was censored in China, wasn't it?
Yes.
And it showed in the United States. Did it ever show in China?
Yes, but it's a different version.
So the film was cut.
Yes.
And were most of the cuts during the part of the Cultural Revolution? The movie traces two characters who are in the Peking Opera.
Yes.
And a part of it takes place during the Cultural Revolution. It takes place over like five decades. So is that the part that they didn't like?
Quite honestly, I don't know. Because they didn't really bother to talk to me. They just give me very, very simple sentence. Like, the film must be released and the film must be cut. So there's nothing specific, like, you know, what you have to cut. I just told them that, you know, if you think there's a need to cut the film, go ahead and do it. But not me. I didn't do it.
You're one of China's most famous artists. And if the censors censor you, that news gets out around the world because your movies show around the world. And
right.
it makes China look bad. Do they care?
They do. They do. So, I mean, so that's why I can receive, you know, the better treatments.
So you get special treatment.
And then other directors, particularly the younger directors. Yeah.
But that's kind of like, you know, if a tree falls in the forest and there's no one there to hear it, has it made a sound? If you make a great film and it's re-edited by the censors and it's no longer a great film, have you made a great film?
Yeah, that's the thing. So that's why, you know, some people are doing the movie underground, meaning that you don't submit the screenplay to the film bureau.
Right.
And you don't really, you know, shoot openly, meaning that there is no press
right
for you.
So can you screen it underground in China, or can
Yes, you can. Yes, you can, because you can develop the film in the lab. You can also show the movie somewhere, you know. But you can't really release the film commercially.
Right.
You can't do that because you don't have the permission. I think it's a pity. I would do something like, I would bring them together, the both sides, the censors and the filmmakers, let them to have a nice talk. Because to me, I feel like it doesn't make sense at all to have this kind of censorship.
Filmmaker Chen Kaiga speaking with Terry Gross. His new film is Together. We'll hear more of their conversation after the break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, Terry's guest is filmmaker Chen Kaiga. His films include Farewell, My Concubine and Temptress Moon. His new movie is called Together.
Your father was a famous filmmaker in China. What kind of movies did your father make?
My father made, you know, literally, you know, dramas. Of course, something really about revolution. And the most famous one is called The Song of Youth.
So this is called Song of Youth?
Yes.
What was it about?
It's about young intellectuals, you know, how they enjoy the revolution in the early 30s in Shanghai and Beijing. So it's also sort of love story, you know, elements there.
Gee, so here he is making a story about how positive the revolution was, but he was punished. He was imprisoned during the Cultural Revolution.
Oh, that's true. Yes.
Why did the government turn against him?
It's not only him. I think the group of intellectuals and filmmakers were not being trusted by the party because of their, you know, political background and their educational background and so on. Mostly that those government officials, you know, who were in charge of the business at that time, were all from countryside. They're not very well educated.
So being intellectual, being sophisticated, even being urban, was something you were going to be punished for.
No, there is a. I guess the main reason was Chairman Mao.
Mm-hmm.
I knew the story that he wasn't very well educated in any university or college. He was sort of self-taught. He was a genius politically. But I guess that he didn't really like those intellectuals. That would become a very big issue during the Cultural Revolution.
Now, I know that this is a story you've talked about before, but when you were young, during the Cultural Revolution, you were asked by the Chinese authorities to denounce your father. How did they approach you?
No, it's not really a Chinese authority. You know, at that time, there's no authority at all except Chairman Mao himself. It's very weird. Those revolutionaries literally were my father's colleagues. They were either lighting men or... just doing the production people. You know, they call themselves workers, but they were not necessarily only workers. And they sort of took action against my father and other directors. And they thought that I was perfect, you know, to be used for them, you know, against my father.
So how did they approach you?
They just, you know, they came to me and just say, well, in the name of a revolution, you must do something, you know. You must disclose some secret of your father. I said, what secret? And they say, you may know that if you don't know, we want to tell you. you know, that will be more powerful if you say that than what we, you know, than we do it. I think human nature is very complicated. At that moment, I think I want to make this as a film in the future. I was very good student of my class, probably one of the best students. I thought that, oh my God, everything's changed overnight. I can't stand that anymore. I feel like I want to prove that I'm still the best student of the class. I want to prove myself as very faithful to Chairman Mao. So I knew that my father wasn't a secret agent for any political party at all. I knew that he was very innocent. But I decided to denounce him because I want to prove I'm innocent. So that is the way of how the political campaign going on there.
So what did you denounce him for?
No, just because I was told that he was the secret agent for Nationalist Party. Of course he wasn't. I just said that in front of public. I mean, I think that's deeply hurt not only my father but myself as well, because, you know, I told lies and I knew he wasn't. But I was, surprisingly, you know, I was sort of, they like it. The revolutionaries just, you know, praise me as a good boy or something.
Right. So you had to do this in public?
No, there is a sort of a struggle session with a couple of, you know, 100 people around in the place where we live. You know, there is a sort of small square, you know, between buildings. So that structure session just taking place there.
You know, it's interesting. Like, good children are brought up to respond well to praise. And you were going to get more praise by denouncing your father.
Yes. What kind of people they are, you know? I got very confused, you know, at that time. Because I mean, what I want to say is that I think I'm very sort of unusual person, meaning that most people at that time kneel down to say, forgive me, this is my fault, all right? In order to get forgiveness from this authority. But after Cultural Revolution, most people just stand up, you know, shouting that that's all their fault.
Or somebody else's fault.
Right. I never really want to do it. I don't want to take the responsibility for what I did. Okay? But I'm the other way around. So at that time, yes, I did make mistake. And then later on, I want to identify with this. I want to say, this is my fault.
Right.
Because if no one want to take the responsibility, something will happen again like that.
What did your father say to you after you denounced him?
He hardly to say anything to me because I guess he was pretty shocked. And he believed that we had very good relationship, although that he always be, you know, he's always away because he was busy making movies. So it seems like, you know, I was quite afraid of my father for one reason or the other because, you know, we didn't really spend a lot of time together. But the relationship eventually being repaired afterwards, you know, in 2 or 3 years' time.
Well, you know, you denounced him and you were like a good boy for doing that in the eyes of the workers who wanted him denounced. And so you temporarily poison your relationship with your father. And at the same time, you're still punished by the Cultural Revolution. You're still shipped out from the city to a province to do hard labor. So did you feel really betrayed?
Not really. Because, you know, I've been sent to the countryside not because, you know, what I did to my father, you know, it's not even considered as a punishment. It's a it's a sort of revolutionary activity.
Right.
You know, I mean, because young people at that time didn't really have any choice but go to the countryside to receive the re-education there by the Chinese peasants. So, yeah, I was pretty happy to leave Beijing at that time.
Why?
Because I thought that this is the beginning of a new life. I was fed up with what happened there. I can't stand that anymore. I just felt I need to go. I need to leave. I'm looking for a new life. No matter what happened, then I'm going to take it.
So what were you assigned to?
To the province called Yunnan Province. It's very remote. It's, southwestern province.
And what kind of work did you have to do?
That's a jungle area that my job was to chop the trees. I consider that as a very bad job because I love trees. I love jungle. I love, you know, the rainforest a lot. But we cut the trees because, you know, we need to plant rubber trees there instead of the real original jungle. That's a terrible job. I hate it. But I was, you couldn't imagine that, how sad I was at that time. Very depressed and no future at all. I have no idea what time I can go back to Beijing. I was, obviously very sort of homesick.
How old were you when you were able to go back?
I was 16 at that time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when I denounced my father, I was 14. Then I was 16, you know, when I left Beijing for Yunnan province.
He was in jail for 2 years. Was that because you denounced him?
No. With or without denouncing of my father, you know, he was in trouble.
Right.
You know, he was sort of nowhere to go.
Chen Kaiga's new film is called Together. We'll continue Terry's interview with him in the second half of the show. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From Universal Studios Home Video and Focus Features, presenting The Pianist, One Man's Struggle and the Survival of the Human Spirit, available on DVD. By the National Endowment for the Arts, and Wiley, publishers of The Iron Triangle, Inside the Secret World of the Carlyle Group, Dan Briety's investigation into the intersection of big business, government, and defense. Available wherever books are sold. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Chinese filmmaker Chen Kaiga. Also, linguist Jeff Nunberg considers the notion that some languages lack the words to describe notions basic to our culture, like compromise or privacy. And our film critic John Powers wishes Bob Hope a happy 100th birthday today.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. Back now to Terry's conversation with filmmaker Chen Kaiga. His films include Yellow Earth, Farewell My Concubine, and Temptress Moon. His new movie is Together. Kaiga's father was imprisoned during the Cultural Revolution. Like Kaiga, he was also a distinguished filmmaker.
You ended up studying film and then, of course, making movies. Did your father's life as a filmmaker inspire you at all to become a filmmaker yourself?
Not really. I remember that I went to the film studio to see my father making a movie that I found is very boring. In 4 hours' time, nothing happened. You know, I asked my father, you know, why you're so slow, and he said that people are setting light.
Right.
You know, that kind of thing. I wasn't, you know, feel like, you know, it's enjoyable to make a movie. My dream was to be a scholar with a piece of paper and a pen holding in my hand, you know, to do a research about Chinese classical literature.
Oh.
That was my dream.
So what happened?
No, I couldn't do it because that I wasn't very well educated in many ways, because I was the first year student of high school when Cultural Revolution broke out. I couldn't pass the general, exam, the regular exam. After school reopened in the year of 1977, that's the year when Cultural Revolution finished. And, yeah.
So you went to film school after the end of the Cultural Revolution.
Yes.
When the schools reopened after having been shut.
Right.
What was it like for the students and for the teachers to be back in school after a few years where there was no school?
I guess that everyone was very excited. Obviously, those professors and teachers who didn't teach for almost 10 years got very excited. And they're so happy to receive the new students. And I remember the first class we had when we became the film students. They said, we didn't know. We didn't teach anyone for 10 years. We don't know how to teach you guys. And obviously, I was very, very happy. I thought that's my, you know, the turning point of my life. Everything now become very positive. I can be a film director. You know, I just, that's really beyond my imagination, because I used to be a peasant, worker, and soldier. So I never thought that I can do a sort of that kind of job, you know. That's a very high job, something.
Did your father ever make movies again after the Cultural Revolution?
Oh, yeah. He did many. But he was getting old.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was sort of isolate from life. And I think he didn't really do that well.
After you reconciled, did you become closer than you had been before you reconciled?
Oh, yeah. I mean, my father really, he was very, very supportive. Although that in the beginning that he totally rejected the idea that I'm going to be a film director with very obvious reasons.
Mm-hmm.
That what happened to him, he doesn't want that kind of things happen to me. But he just said to be a film director is really a nasty job. It's difficult. But you have to remember one thing. That I mean, since you did, the decision is made, you will never give up. I that's unforgettable. What he said to me, I will remember that forever. My father already passed away for 9 years, so I still remember him. You know what he said to me, and so on.
Can you repeat what he said to you?
He said that. He said many things to me, but, you know, there's only one thing I remember, which is that he said, never give up. As a film director, you have to sort of dig deeper and deeper to find out the new elements of human nature. That's your job. Your job is not just going to make more money than other people. And you have to know yourself. I'm so happy that you know, you understand yourself better than before. You didn't know who you were, so that's why you denounced me. Now you knew that. I'm sure that, I mean, you told me that you have made mistake. So I'm so happy that I forgive you, not because that you are my son, only because that you represent the future of our family. And you are not going to do the same thing again. I'm pretty sure about that. I'm comfortable with that. That's what he said to me.
I can see now why the music teacher in your new movie Together is based on your father, the music teacher who believes in the purity of music and in playing with your heart and in not worrying about fame or fortune.
Right.
Now, the advice your father gave you is difficult to advice to live by, making movies in China in a world where your scripts and your movies are censored. Because if you're going to be investigating matters of the human heart and human nature, you're going to be dealing in the world of ambiguity. And you're going to be dealing in the world where people aren't necessarily nice or doing the right thing, and where people certainly aren't necessarily supporting the communist government. And that's exactly the kind of stuff that the government isn't going to want you to be describing in your movies. Mm-hmm. You're just going to be at odds all the time.
Well, I'm still struggling. I think that I know better why my father said that, never give up.
Mm-hmm.
It's not an easy job, you know. But I'm used to this. You know, I'm comfortable with who I am. And I become more calm than before.
In the mid-90s, after you made your movie, Temptress Moon, you said, I'm not ready to make a film about contemporary China because nothing is interesting now. Step by step, everything has been destroyed. Your new movie, Together, is about contemporary China. What changed for you that made you feel like you were ready to make a movie about contemporary China?
Well, you know, I used to be very angry because of my personal experience, you know, my experience about Cultural Revolution. I feel like the culture has been, you know, completely destroyed. This is my attitude towards what happened in the Chinese society. I feel like there's no sort of high culture at all. But now I become, you know, optimistic because the first thing I want to do is to be honest with myself. I used to focus on the history. Focus on what happened in the past. You know, doing something like, you know, Emperor Assassin or Temperance Moon, because the history itself is just like that. I'm very proud of the film called Emperor and Assassin, because at least I told the people story about the first emperor who began the dictatorship in China. So he was the one who created the whole system, and he got a lot of followers even now. That's very important. But now I want to be honest with myself again, because I have seen many, many positive steps being taken in the society. And people are paying more attention to the culture. People are realize that, you know, the mistake they have made before. For example, when I see, something happen in front of me, like the old wall of Beijing being turned down, you see the huge smoke, you know, going up to the sky. Then I was very, very sad and angry. It's a long time ago. Uh-huh. You know, then people ask me, why you think it's so precious to have this kind of wall? I said, look,
of
the city.
The wall of the city being torn down.
Yeah, I just say, look, this is our protection. You know, I take any kind of art form, including music and art, you know, fine arts, cinema, as the protection of human nature. Without that, how can we call ourselves human beings? Now I think, you know, some very interesting happened. Very interesting things happen in Chinese society now. Something is very good, really. I think that this is a happy film, meaning that Chinese people are learning how to be happy. Happiness the genuine happiness is a gift given by our Creator, you know, God, you may say. If you don't know how to be happy, how can you call yourself as a rich people? You're not rich because you don't know anything about happiness. You see that particularly the young boy and his father. The young boy is just like a sunshine, you know, I mean, just coming into the life of those adults. Those professors and people like Lily, they're not necessarily happy. They're struggling to make more money, to, you know, to get the fame they want. You know, I mean, but I think this young boy lived a natural life. You know, he never really considered that I want to be rich and famous.
Chen Kaiga, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you
very much.
Chen Kaiga's new film is called Together. It opens tomorrow in New York, San Francisco, and Los Angeles, and nationwide next month. Coming up, when language gets in the way of politics. This is Fresh Air. The difficulties in reaching a Middle East settlement have a lot of people talking about how stubborn both sides are. And some have claimed that the problem is partly linguistic, since Arabic doesn't have a word for compromise. To our linguist Jeff Nunberg, those are just old stereotypes wrapped in a new package.
A couple of months ago, the Oxford Dictionary of Quotations published its list of the top 100 sayings of 2002. It included this remark, which President Bush was supposed to have made to Tony Blair. The problem with the French is that they have no word for entrepreneur. After the list appeared, though, a spokesman for the prime minister denied that Bush had ever said anything of the sort. I believe that. The line really sounds too pat to be true, like a story the English would cook up to put in the mouth of an ignorant American. What makes the story plausible, though, is that you're always hearing people say this. The so-and-so people don't have a word for such-and-such, where the absence of the word is supposed to shed a telling light on a people's culture. At one time or another, I've heard it said that the French don't have a word for nice, that German doesn't have a word for fair play, and that Chinese doesn't have a word for privacy. Back in 1985, President Reagan asserted that the Russian language didn't have a word for freedom. Of course it does, svoboda, but Reagan was never one to let details get in the way of a good story. I saw another one of these the other day when a friend sent me a link to an article that had appeared a while ago in the Egyptian newspaper Al-Ahram and which had been widely reprinted on the web. Its author was an Egyptian businessman and writer named Tariq Hegi, who claimed Arabic has no word for compromise. For the Arabs, he said, compromise is associated with submission and weakness, whereas the Anglo-Saxon nations value the ideas of compromise and a respect for the opinions of others. Now, I don't know Arabic, but that claim struck me as pretty bizarre on the face of things. Sometimes you can conclude that a people lacks a certain concept from the fact that they don't have a word for it, but that's usually because it's a notion they can live without. You're not surprised to learn that Tibetan doesn't have words for squeeze play or happy hour. But it's hard to imagine how any people could run a global civilization without having a way of talking about compromise, or for that matter, how they could manage their daily lives. I mean, where would that leave you? I wanted to spend our whole two-week vacation at the beach, and my wife wanted to spend it in the mountains, so we had to get a divorce. I checked with a couple of Arabic linguists who confirmed that Arabic has several items that translate the English word compromise. I'm not sure why Hegge would think Arabs didn't have the notion, but probably it's because the most common way to speak of compromise in Arabic is to use a phrase rather than a single word. You say, we reached a middle ground. But then we do the same thing when we talk about a meeting of the minds or meeting someone halfway. The fact is that people have plenty of concepts that their language doesn't give them a single word for. Take the German word Schadenfreude, which denotes the pleasure we take in the misfortunes of others. I'll grant you it's a nice item to have handy in a prepackaged form. But that doesn't mean that Red Sox fans have to learn German before they can enjoy watching the Yankees lose 8 straight at home. Still, people keep pointing to these gaps in the dictionary as if they had a profound cultural significance. More often than not, it's just a way of dressing an old racial stereotype in a new kind of cognitive garb. The fact is that Westerners have always attributed an unwillingness to compromise to the Arabs and the other Semitic peoples. According to T.E. Lawrence of Arabia fame, the Semites have no halftones in their register of vision. And after the failure of the British government's 1948 partition plan for Palestine, the English historian Elizabeth Monroe explained the breakdown by saying that the British were full of the capacity for compromise and couldn't understand that they were dealing with two peoples of the most uncompromising race in the world. The only difference is that back then, nobody felt the need to say that the Jews and the Arabs lacked a word for compromise. They just assumed that obstinacy was bred in the Semitic bone. But then you could make the same point about us Anglophones if you were of a mind to. For example, we tend to use uncompromising as a morally complimentary term nowadays. She's an uncompromising perfectionist. Why is that necessarily a good thing? And we only use the adjective compromised with a negative meaning. The ambassador was too compromised to serve as an intermediary. But language doesn't just give us the names of concepts, but ways of seeing them in different lights. Someone who strikes us as uncompromising on Monday can come to seem inflexible or obstinate by the end of the week, once we start to see the need of cutting a deal. If the players really want to find a compromise in the Middle East, they'll find the words for it.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at Stanford University and the author of The Way We Talk Now. Coming up, Bob Hope turns 100. This is Fresh Air. Bob Hope turns 100 today. His official career in show business spanned 75 years. He did everything from vaudeville to Broadway, from radio to television. He also made more than 50 films. 17 of them have recently been reissued on DVD, including 4 road movies co-starring Bing Crosby and Dorothy L'Amour. Our film critic John Powers has been home watching movies and has these thoughts on the hugely influential film career of Bob Hope.
I still remember the first Bob Hope movie I ever saw. I must have been 7 or 8, and my family was living in the small town of Martinsdale, Iowa. My mom yelled for me to come into the living room. "You've got to see this," she said, pointing at the TV screen, where Bob Hope and Bing Crosby were sitting on the sand, jawing back and forth in a way that I didn't find especially funny. But then somehow a camel showed up and spit right in Hope's eye, an animal ad-lib so utterly unexpected that Hope lurched back in shock, while Crosby hooted with laughter. My mother and I hooted, too. And I was hooked. I sat and watched the rest of the movie, The Road to Morocco, startled to discover just how much funnier Bob Hope was in the movies than on those TV specials that my parents liked so much. Over the years, I saw a lot more of Hope's movies, maybe 50 or so, and though a lot of them were pretty darn bad, especially the ones from the 1960s, that was almost beside the point, which was to watch Bob Hope. for he wasn't just a terrific screen actor who knew how to deliver a wisecrack in every possible key signature. With his ski nose, jeering smile, and aggressive chin, he sometimes seemed to act with his jaw. Hope forged one of the most enduring personas in modern movies. He was the jumpy braggart, the wisecracking coward, the would-be ladies' man who's forever eyeballing women who seem hopelessly out of his league. When he wasn't losing Dorothy L'Amour to Crosby, he was sleeping with horses in his westerns, or nearly getting raped by a gorilla in The Road to Bali. For many people, his most beloved films are the six road pictures he made with Crosby, whose vaguely posh, often comatose-seeming calm made him the perfect foil to the wired, less educated Hope. Anyone seeing these movies for the first time today might well be surprised that they were so popular, for they seem so lazy and protracted, a bit like those Saturday Night Live skits that get turned into a movie. But for an earlier generation, these movies had a different aura. When Hope and Crosby set off on the road to Singapore or Bali or Hong Kong or Rio, they were about as hip as Hollywood got in those more innocent days. For the road pictures were a double spoof. They not only sent up formulaic adventure stories that other Hollywood movies were presenting seriously, they made fun of how these movies were made. Even as most movies worked hard to make their backlots seem like a foreign country, so Casablanca was supposed to take place in the real Morocco, the road pictures always jokingly announced they were being shot on a back lot, and that viewers were, of course, sitting in a movie theater. "He's gonna sing, folks," Hope announces before one of Crosby's numbers. "Now's the time to go get your popcorn." Occasionally, this got to be too much, and watching the movies again recently, I was struck by how many tired Hollywood in-jokes show up in these road pictures. But the chemistry between Hope and Crosby was always so strong that it carried him past this, giving their work together an exuberance that often led them to song. Here, they're sitting atop that spitting camel as it carries them across an endless expanse of sand in the Sahara.
"You think we got enough gas?
I got our carburetor cut down to nothing. Where do you suppose we are?"
"This must be the place where they empty all the old hourglasses.
I think this is what's left after I clean my spinach. Hey, look.
I could have thought of another way to get us here.
Here we go again, Junior.
We're off on the road to Morocco. This taxi is tough on the spine.
Beats the bus, huh, Junior?
Oh, beats me.
Where we're going,
why we're going, how can we be sure?
I'll lay you 8 to 5 that we meet Dorothy L'Amour. Off on the road to Morocco. Hang on till the end of the line. I hear this country's where they do the dance of the seven veils. We tell you more, but we would have the censor on our tails. We certainly do get around. Like Webster's Dictionary, we're Morocco bound."
Of course, Hope made scores of movies without Bing Crosby, and it's amazing how many of them have the same structure. Wisecracking Bob plays a small-timer who gets in some sort of trouble. In The Pale Face, he's painless Peter Potter, a frontier dentist who marries Jane Russell, unaware that she's really Calamity Jane. In the noir spoof My Favorite Brunette, he's a photographer who gets mixed up with gangsters. In My Favorite Blonde, he's a music hall performer with a trained penguin who gets involved with Nazi spies. And in Ghostbreakers, perhaps a precursor of Ghostbusters, he plays a radio personality who gets hooked up with apparently supernatural beings. His character there is named Lawrence L. Lawrence, whose middle initial also stands for Lawrence. My parents, Hope says, lacked imagination. Through all these pictures, Hope was essentially the same. He talked big and acted small, often got the girl you'd think he'd never could get, and he did it all while delivering the endless quips that his huge team of writers always stuffed into his movies. I don't say this dismissively, for Hope's comic formula has been copied by everyone from Woody Allen to Bill Murray. Allen, in particular, has long celebrated Hope's movie acting and freely admits that his own screen persona bears strong affinities to Hope's. Woody is just the updated, neurotic, intellectual version. There was nothing remotely neurotic about Hope's own screen image, whose most striking feature may be its almost total lack of any kind of interiority. Where Allen is filled with angst, Groucho bursting with libidinous anarchy, or W.C. Fields shot through with melancholic misanthropy, Hope always stays on the surface. With Chaplin or Keaton, you saw through to the comic's very soul. This never happens with Hope, who is always content to stay within the safe limits of the gag, the crack, the one-liner. His films were never really about anything. Of all our screen comedians, Hope is the glibbest, and potentially one of the most sinister. Although he always hit it, you can see all manner of meanness glinting through those aggressive wisecracks. And had he lived in a different age, Hope would have made a great antagonist for 007. Thanks for the memory, Mr. Bond. I've long thought I would have loved to have seen him cast as Noah Cross, John Huston's role in Chinatown, which wouldn't really have been much of a stretch. Although Huston had that rumbling voice and Billy Goat gruff appearance, he was never in showbiz for the money. Hope always was. Indeed, he became one of the richest men in Southern California by investing in San Fernando Valley real estate, the very theme of Chinatown. But to imagine him playing such a dark role is to imagine a different Bob Hope. I grew up watching him make jokes about never getting the Oscar, but the truth was he never really tried. He never wanted to risk his persona by moving too far from what made him successful. And who can blame him? For Hope was really great at what he did. He knew his way around a wisecrack. Nobody ever timed a gag better. He knew how to dance, and in a movie like The Road to Rio, you see him cut loose with genuine brio. And like Fred Astaire, another Hollywood star with a seemingly unpromising voice, he knew how to put across a song, like the Oscar-winning tune Buttons and Bows, which he sang to Jane Russell in The Pale Face. In all these things, Bob Hope was satisfied to be a consummate professional. And in days when too many comedians think of themselves as artists or geniuses, such respect for his craft is no small thing.
John Powers is film critic and media columnist for LA Weekly. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today was Roberta Shorrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, Monique Nazareth, and Anne-Marie Baldonado, with Patty Leswing, Jessica Chu, and Ian Chillog. Seuss Boland directed the show. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave. We'll close with Bob Hope singing this Academy Award-winning song from the film The Pale Face. Bob Hope, happy 100th birthday.
A western ranch is just a branch of nowhere junction to me. Give me the city where living's pretty and the gals wear finery. East is east and west is west and the wrong one I have chose. Let's go where you'll keep on wearing those frills and flowers and buttons and bows, rings and things and buttons and bows. Don't bury me in this prairie, take me where the cement grows. Let's move down to some big town where they love a gal by the cut of her clothes. And you'll stand out in buttons and bows. I love you in buckskin or skirts that you've homespun. But I love you longer, stronger, where your friends don't tote a gun. My bones denounce the buckboard bounce and the cactus hurts my toes.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Learning to Fall, The Blessings of an Imperfect Life by Philip Simmons. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, David Benioff talks about adapting his book 25th Hour into a film directed by Spike Lee. It stars Edward Norton as a drug dealer who has one day left on the outside before beginning his 7-year prison sentence. It's now out on video. Join us for the next Fresh Air.